Hey, it's Nishant, and welcome to Higher IQ. It's Saturday, May 16th, and in 1962, in what was then Tanganyika, now Tanzania, a group of schoolgirls started laughing. Nobody remembers when it started, but what followed was one of the strangest events in medical history. The laughter spread from student to student, then from school to school to the surrounding community, then to neighboring villages. It lasted about 6 months. Schools were shut down, nearly 1,000 people were affected, and there was no joke. There was no comedy, it was just laughter, spreading like a virus, overwhelming anyone that it touched. We're covering this today because everyone laughs. Everyone thinks they understand humor, but almost nobody can explain why a particular thing is funny and another thing isn't. The science of humor has produced a surprisingly good answer, and it also reveals that most laughter has nothing to do with being funny at all. For centuries, philosophers have been trying to build a unified theory of humor. Plato and Aristotle thought we laugh because we feel superior to others. Freud thought humor was a release valve for repressed thoughts and desires. Incongruity theory, the dominant view for most of the 20th century, said that we laugh at things that violate our expectations, a mismatch between what we expect and what actually happens. The problem was that none of these theories worked alone. Superiority theory can't explain puns. Relief theory can't explain slapstick. Incongruity theory can't explain why some surprises are funny and others are just confusing or upsetting. As Peter McGraw, a behavioral scientist at the University of Colorado, put it, it didn't make sense that we needed three theories of humor. A good theory is parsimonious. In 2010, McGraw and his collaborator, Caleb Warren, published a paper in a psychological science proposing what they called the benign violation theory, the idea that something is funny when three conditions are met simultaneously. There's a violation, meaning something that threatens your sense of how the world should work. The violation is benign, which means it feels safe or harmless, and you perceive both at the same time. Tickling is the simplest example. Someone grabs you and squeezes. That's a physical threat, a violation. But it's coming from someone you trust, so it's benign. And then you laugh. Now change the context. The same physical sensation from a stranger in a dark alley isn't funny at all. The violation is real. The benign part is gone. The theory also explains why you can't tickle yourself. There's no violation when you're the one doing it. Your brain knows it's safe before anything happens, so there's nothing to resolve. The benign violation framework explains something comedians have always known intuitively. Timing matters because distance determines whether a violation feels safe. A joke about a car accident is offensive the day it happens and hilarious a year later. The violation hasn't changed, the distance has. There's a saying, comedy is a tragedy plus time. But that's not just a saying. It's a description of how the brain recategorizes a violation from threatening to benign as emotional distance increases. The theory also explains why humor is so subjective. Whether a violation feels benign depends on your personal norms, your culture, and your personal relationship to the subject. A sexist joke is funnier to people who are less committed to gender equality norms, because for them, the violation is smaller. A joke about death is funnier to someone who isn't grieving. The violation is the same. The perception of safety varies from person to person. Two people can hear the same joke, and one laughs while the other is offended, and both responses are internally consistent. The most surprising finding in laughter research is that most laughter has nothing to do with humor. Robert Provine, a neuroscientist at the University of Maryland who spent decades studying laughter in natural settings, recorded over 1,200 instances of laughter in everyday conversation. He found that fewer than 20% of laughs followed anything that could be classified as a joke or funny remark. People laughed after saying things like, "I'll see you guys later," and "It was nice meeting you too." The laughter wasn't a response to comedy. It was a social signal. Provine's research revealed a series of patterns that most people would never notice. Speakers laugh more than their audience, which is the opposite of what you'd expect if laughter was a primary response to someone else being funny. Women laugh more at things men say than vice versa, regardless of how funny the content actually is. Laughter is almost always occurring at the end of a phrase or sentence, rarely in the middle, as though the brain respects the punctuation of speech, even when the body is losing control. Laughter is also contagious in a way that almost no other human behavior is. You're 30 times more likely to laugh in the presence of another person than alone. Laugh tracks on television sitcoms work, even though they're obviously fake, because the sound of other people laughing activates an involuntary mimicry response. The Tanganyika epidemic was an extreme expression of this. Laughter spreading from person to person the way yawning does, bypassing conscious control entirely. Robin Dunbar, an evolutionary psychologist at Oxford, has argued that laughter evolved as a social bonding mechanism that predates language. In groups of primates, social bonds are maintained through physical grooming, one individual picking through another's fur. Grooming releases endorphins and builds trust, but it only works one-on-one. Laughter, Dunbar proposed, is grooming at a distance. It releases the same endorphins, but can happen in a group, with everyone bonding simultaneously. This would explain why laughter is so deeply social, why it's nearly impossible to suppress, and why it appears in every human culture ever studied. It wasn't designed for comedy. It was designed for connection. Comedy is just figuring out how to hijack it. The benign violation theory has a practical implication that's worth sitting with. If humor lives at the intersection of threat and safety, then the funniest material is always closest to the line. Too safe, and there's no violation, nothing to laugh at. Too threatening, and the benign interpretation collapses. Nothing funny about it. The best comedians spend their careers finding the edge and dancing on it. This is why comedy ages. A joke from the 1970s that was considered edgy might feel tame now because cultural norms have shifted and the violation has shrunk. A joke from 10 years ago might feel offensive now because the line moved, and what was once perceived as benign is now perceived as a real violation. The joke didn't change, but the audience norms did. It's also why the funniest people in your lives aren't necessarily the ones telling the best jokes. They're the ones who understand your specific norms well enough to violate them in exactly the right way. Inside jokes work because shared context creates these shared norms, and the violation can be more precise when both people know what's being violated. A joke between close friends can be devastating and hilarious in a way that the same joke between strangers would just be confusing. Humor is a social technology, and it runs on shared information. The Tanganyika epidemic is still not fully understood. Some researchers classify it as a mass psychogenic illness, a stress response that manifested as uncontrollable laughter in a population under social and economic pressure. The girls at the school where it started were from low-income families navigating a country in the early years of independence. The laughter may not have been humor at all. It may have been the body's emergency pressure valve, the relief theory that Freud proposed, expressing itself at a scale nobody had seen before or has since. 6 months of laughter with no joke. The body doing what it does when the social and emotional load becomes too much to process through normal channels. So if this comes up in conversation, here's how to think about it. The best theory of humor we have says something is funny when it's a violation that also simultaneously feels safe. Tickling works because a trusted person is mock attacking you. A joke about tragedy works years later, but not the day it happens. Whether a violation feels benign depends on your personal norms, which is why humor is subjective and why comedy ages. Most laughter isn't about humor at all. Fewer than 20% of natural laughs follow anything funny. Laughter is a social bonding mechanism that predates language, releasing endorphins the same way grooming does in primates, but works at a distance and in groups. Comedy didn't create laughter. It just learned to use it. The funniest people in your life are the ones who know your norms well enough to violate them in exactly the right ways. That's not a talent, it's a relationship. Stay informed, stay curious, and we'll see you tomorrow.